human history. This has been Black History Month 365. Bam! 365, where you find every day Black History is made.
The unruffled beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Wednesday, 8 p.m. And time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. We are honored to be placed in this coveted spot where Jay Lee and his crew on Tech Bites have been for so many years. So, if you're expecting technology bites, stay with us, because we've been around a few years, too, on Thursdays at 10, and our team would like nothing more than to keep your 8 p.m. Wednesday tuning habits to continue. So give us a shot. I'm Hank Rubicek, the person who created this program back in late 2007 as an open journal before moving around a bit and landing right here. And along with our team, co-hosts Dr. Mary Edgerton, who will be your maestro tonight, Warren Holloman, Greg Audell, engineer Nicole Rochelin, syndicator Alondra Mejia, and newest member of our squad, Lisa Moore, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through enchanted worlds and through windows of their souls with personal stories that stretch the boundaries of the human heart. Something we don't do enough on KPFT is to tout the excellence of other programs that help create our eclectic program inventory. Many of our programs are inextricably related, such as So What's Your Story with The Prison Show, aired every Friday at 9 p.m. Created by Ray Hill in March 1980 and hosted for a long time by the talented Hank Lam and Holly Carmen, the show connects prisoners with families and communities by talking about courts, jail, prisons, probation, parole, as well as the collective fear and loneliness that infests the minds of inmates. And tonight, on our Wednesday debut, we'll explore thoughts from prisoners through the stories they tell and the stories we tell about them. Now, I'd like to turn it off to Mary.
Hey, thanks, Hank. And I'm beginning to see, I think Hank's associated with talent. I'm thinking of changing my name. Anyway, we have the good fortune of having attorney Ann Clayton in our studio tonight to tell us a really incredible story about exoneration. And first, a little bit about Ann. She's a lawyer with Darlene Walker & Associates. Some 20 years ago, she worked with Vincent and Elkins, another Houston law firm. In the early 1990s, she was asked by the firm to work on a pro bono case at the request of the Mexican consulate. It was an appeal for Ricardo Aldape Guerra, a Mexican national who had been convicted of murdering a policeman in 1982, and since then had been on death row, trying to have his conviction overturned. So, Anne, welcome. You're our debut guest for the one-hour show. Feeling any pressure?
Let's hope I work well under pressure.
Hey, that's the kind of lawyer I want. All right. I do want to mention that Nicole Cazares, an attorney for the wrongfully accused death row inmate Anthony Graves, was Hank's guest on June 30th of last year. And she reminded us that in 2010, it was the prison show that gave her the means to inform Mr. Graves of his exoneration. Literally, an inmate that heard her convey the incredible news on the air that night told Mr. Graves about it. This is both a station and collection of listeners that care deeply about the kind of story that you're about to tell us. So, Ann, you're our Wednesday debut guest. You're following in the footsteps of Nicole Cazares and a great tradition. No pressure there, because I know you're going to do a great job with this story.
Thanks, Mary. My part in this story begins when Scott Atlas, the partner who is the head of the Vincent and Elkins pro bono committee, asked for assistance on this case. The main reason I agreed was that, upon hearing the facts of the case, I could not conceive how a Houston jury could have convicted this man, Ricardo Aldape Guerra, of capital murder. So the facts of the case are essentially that in July of 1982, a police officer on patrol was flagged down by a man walking on the street of an East Houston neighborhood who reported that a car was driving recklessly. The police went in search of the car. Soon thereafter, the officer found a vehicle stalled on the street which matched the description of the car that had been driving recklessly. The officer ordered the two men in the vehicle to approach the police car and place their hands on the hood of the car. One man followed the officer's instructions and was placing his hands on the hood of the police car when the other drew a Browning 9mm pistol and tragically shot the police officer three times at point-blank range. He then proceeded to take the officer's gun and shot another man who was sitting in his car with his two children. At this point, both men ran off after the shootings. One man, Roberto Carrasco Flores, was found an hour later hiding in a garage. Upon being discovered, this man, Mr. Flores, engaged in a shootout with the police and was eventually shot and killed himself. Now, after he was shot, the police discovered that he was holding the murder weapon, the weapon that had been used in the shootout, the weapon that had been used to shoot the police officer, and the weapon that had been used to shoot the bystander, the man in his car. Additionally, they found tucked in his waistband the police officer's weapon. In addition to that, they found an ammo clip in a holster on his belt that had an additional clip for that Browning 9mm pistol. Our client, Aldape, was found a short time after that under a trailer. He was unarmed at the time, he surrendered peacefully, and the police found nearby to him a .45 caliber weapon wrapped in a bandana that had not been used to shoot anyone that evening. So you ask yourself at this point, how could Ricardo Aldape Guerra be tried and convicted of capital murder if all the physical evidence points to Flores being the shooter? Well, this presented a real problem for the police and the prosecution because one man was guilty of shooting a police officer and a bystander, and the other man was guilty of nothing, of just being there at the time. And how could they explain to the jury this evidence? Well, they came up with this bizarre theory that after the first police officer and the bystander were killed, but before the police shootout with Mr. Flores, Aldape and Flores traded weapons. When I first heard this, I was incredulous. What person would take a gun from someone who had just shot a police officer and an innocent bystander? It makes no sense. Besides which, there was zero evidence to support this gun-switching theory. The other problem the police and the prosecution had with this case was that none of the initial witness statements pointed unequivocally to Aldape as the shooter. In fact, some of these initial statements clearly point to Flores as being the shooter, which is consistent with all the physical evidence. Most of the witnesses were Hispanic teens or children. And the federal court who ended up reviewing this case said that, in essence, the police and the prosecution, after Mr. Flores' death, engaged in outrageous misconduct in order to convict Aldape of capital murder. And the only way they could do that was if Aldape was the shooter. So, the things they did after the initial witness statements, they decided to hold this a lineup and include Aldape, because remember, at this point, Mr. Flores is dead. Right before the lineup, they paraded Aldape in handcuffs through a hallway where all the witnesses were sitting. They then paraded him back down the hallway a short time afterwards, all before the lineup. Additionally, they let all the witnesses sit together in the hallway. And one of the only adult witnesses was overheard trying to convince the other witnesses that since Mr. Flores was dead, they could all point to Aldape as being the shooter. And there was evidence that she had discriminatory animus The reason she was doing this is because Mr. Aldape and Mr. Flores were both undocumented workers. And she said the only reason, and then she used a discriminatory term to define an illegal alien, which I won't use or share with you. The only reason for them to be here in the United States is to take jobs from American citizens and to commit crimes. What other threats and intimidation did the prosecution and police engage in? Well, the police, for one of the young witnesses, they threatened to revoke the parole of her common-law husband. Another one, they threatened to take her baby away. She was a young Hispanic female mother. Another witness, they handcuffed his mother on the night of the shooting for telling the police that she had seen nothing, that she was in her house, and they told her she had a duty to help. And so they handcuffed her and put her in the police car. Another thing they did was the night of the shooting, several men came to testify that they were pulling innocent men out of their houses, throwing them to the ground, pointing guns to the back of their heads, and accusing them of being the shooters. These were not shooters. They were just men in the neighborhood. Also, after the lineup, the witnesses gave second statements. And in some of these statements, the witnesses said Aldape was not the shooter. Mysteriously, these statements were not included in that second set of statements. And the witnesses didn't know that because many of them didn't read English or they had limited reading skills. And when they asked the police, "Would you please read my statement back to me?" the police told them, "Just sign it." Now, the prosecution then joins in this misconduct. Twice before trial, they pulled the witnesses who they thought would be favorable to the prosecution together, and they brought them one evening down to the scene of the shooting so they could walk through the case and get everybody's story straight. This is not lawful. When you have an eyewitness, the eyewitness should come testify as to what they saw, not be allowed to hear other witnesses' testimony and create this cohesive event. Besides which, one of the witnesses who was at the walkthrough tells the prosecution, "You've got it wrong. It's Mr. Flores who's the shooter. I saw it." And the prosecution tells her at that point, "Sorry, your witness statement doesn't say that, and you can't change your mind at this point. You have to testify to what's in your witness statement," even though the police had not recorded properly her statement that Aldape was not the shooter. Now, there were other things that went on. One of the things that I worked on was the fact that under U.S. Supreme Court law, the prosecution's required to turn over to the defense any information that's exculpatory, anything that they find out in their investigation. So the statements that were supposed to be in these witness statements saying that Aldape was not the shooter, that's a violation of this right to due process to receive exculpatory information. They also did not tell the defense attorney that on Mr. Flores' left hand, there were two trace metal patterns, and they failed to turn this over, and there was evidence at trial that the shooter was left-handed. Now, there were some other weird things that went on. So when you have an eyewitness case, you want to make it clear who you're identifying as the shooter. Well, to help themselves out, the prosecution created two life-size mannequins, and they dressed them in the clothing the men were wearing, the actual clothing that night. Well, it was easy for the witnesses to tell who was who because Mr. Flores' clothes were bloody because he had been in a shootout and bullet-ridden. This is a real problem, right? It's essentially coaching your witness to say what people were wearing and who did what. The other odd thing that happened was in 1993, when there was an evidentiary hearing about police and prosecution misconduct, the lead detective came to testify. And he testified that Aldape, our client, was found on the night of the shooting with the murder weapon. This was a fact that was never in dispute. As a matter of fact, this is why the prosecution had to come up with this bizarre theory, because the police had found him in the shootout, Mr. Flores, with the murder weapon, not our client. And essentially, at this point, the federal judge took over the questioning of the detective in order to try to make it, give him a chance to work himself out of this statement. And nonetheless, he doubled down and said our client was found with the murder weapon. Well, the judge kind of got upset, and he essentially turned to the state's attorneys and said, you have a few minutes to figure this out. I'm calling a recess. Also, at that same evidentiary hearing, Scott Atlas, who was the partner who was representing Aldape and helping us, he was questioning one of the district attorneys, and the district attorney wouldn't answer the question. And so he insisted, on asking the question again. And the district attorney said, I've already answered that. And he said, well, I don't believe you have. And at this point, the district attorney tells him, do you want to take this out in the hallway so we can settle this?
Texas style?
Yeah. That's an amazing story. And it's amazing that the judge actually had to lean in and begin the questioning. You were a young lawyer then. What was going through your mind when that happened?
I can tell you I was aghast, as were the row of young lawyers who were sitting behind the defense table. And there was a flurry of papers that were being flown back and forth. Of course, we all knew this was a real problem.
For them. Yeah.
For them.
For them.
Yes, because this is the point at which the police are supposed to, and prosecution are supposed to be arriving and saying, we tried this man fairly. And instead, they're engaging in further misconduct.
So real quick, how did you first meet Mr. Flores?
Aldape?
Mr. Aldape, yes.
Yes. So I met Aldape when he was brought back to Houston for the evidentiary hearing. He was brought back to the jail here in Houston, and he reported that he had been beaten by the police the night he was brought. And so I went down to the jail to take his statement on the second night and to make sure that he was okay and was being treated fairly. And they had also not fed him. So I was there to make sure that.
Had you ever been to a jail before?
I had never been to the jail.
How'd that go?
It was kind of interesting. When I was first asked, I thought I would just go down there by myself. And of course, when other corporate lawyers who were at the firm heard that I was going to do this, they were all aghast and insisted that I have an escort, and luckily I brought an escort who could translate, because I forgot that he did not speak much English and I don't speak any Spanish.
Oh, that is an amazing story, and the lengths to what they went through to try to convict him, or to convict him, successfully convict him. So everybody out there, you are listening to my guest storyteller, Ann Clayton, on our Wednesday debut of So What's Your Story, only on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.9 in Huntsville. And don't forget, for my listeners far beyond that, just go to kpfd.org, live streaming. And for our listeners in Houston, you don't have to run your car so that you can listen to your radio if you don't have one in the house. Go to your computer, live streaming. And I'm your host here, Dr. Mary Edgerton, with Nicole Rochelin on the boards, and my co-hosts, all co-hosts, on hand for our inaugural one-hour show this Wednesday night. Hey, Nicole.
Hey, Mary.
Hey, here we are on Wednesdays at 8. Now even those of us without insomnia can actually watch the show.
You know, and Dr. Hank and I no longer have to take a nap before we get to the station.
That's good, Nicole. Actually, you're being kind. No. Out of the two of us, I'm the one over 30. I'm
the one who. You are?
I'm actually, I know I do not look it, but I am over 30.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Nicole, Houston has truly become a great storytelling town. How about telling us about some of those other storytelling venues around?
Absolutely, Mary. To start, everyone needs to follow us on our Facebook, and we would love it if you would like us when you leave. We also have program clips on our YouTube channel and all our past So What's Your Story programs on the Houston Storytellers website at www.houstonstorytellers.org. Just go to the radio program and enjoy. The Guild is also our proud sponsor, and their swap meets the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emmanuel, located 1500 Sunset. Also, don't miss our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month.
So, Nicole, you psyched about this current time and spot?
I am ecstatic about this new spot in time. And I'm so happy, too, that we both are wearing the same shade of lipstick.
Hey, so. We are, everybody. And I never do a show without lipstick. Okay, Lisa. Lisa's our newest intern. And Lisa, you were a guest on our show last September. Want to say hello?
Hi, everyone.
Hey. Good to see you. Lisa told us a very touching story about her
Lisa
dog.
Lisa took a speech course. She could say more than that.
Who was her professor?
Professor... Yeah, Hank Rubicek.
Yeah. Oh, Hank, there's that name again, I'm telling you.
And that's all you can say.
I'm so excited about this new change that's coming up, though. I'm so excited to hear about the new stories that are coming. So this is going to be amazing for this new time slot.
We're going to have a full hour. And so all our listeners who know us and our new listeners who are joining us, this is going to be a lot of fun. So stick with us. We have a little bit more to go right here. And Ann, your next story is an epilogue of sorts. So what happened to Ricardo Guerra?
Well, he was eventually released from Houston prison, and he was brought back to Mexico, and he was a bit of a cause celeb there. He was asked to play himself on a Mexican soap opera and went back to his hometown where he got to reunite with his family. And tragically, however, 4 months later, he was killed in an automobile accident.
That is a tragic ending, and... Although I think it was wonderful for his mother to see him freed and to live with him, imagine that, everybody out there who's listening, 4 months after 15 years of wrongful conviction. 4 months after 15 years. But we're going to take another story. So, Anne, tonight's stories have talked about faith and justice and hope. And here in this next story... I'd like to talk a little bit about another death row case, or introduce a guest to tell us a story about another death row case. Ricardo Guerra and Anthony Graves and others who were exonerated from the Texas prisons actually were released at the end of their 15 years. But some were not, and Carla Faye Tucker was one that was not. She was the first woman in over 100 years to be executed in the state of Texas at the end of the last century, which was only a few years ago. And her story will be told now through the eyes of someone who knew her. Our own Greg Audell knew Carla Faye very well. And so, Greg, can you tell us something about Carla Faye?
I need to tell you, thank you for asking me to tell the story, because I've intentionally not spoken about Carla for over 15 years. She was a close friend. And... I admired the woman she became. There are many innocent death row inmates. Carla was not. She was not innocent. And so what I'm going to ask people to do is think about a child that you love. Picture that child at 12 years old, and you know what you want to do is you want to protect them. You want them to be safe. Carla didn't grow up in that world. Her mother was a hooker who realized when Carla was 12, and her mother was a heroin addict who realized when Carla was 12, this is a moneymaker. And how do you get a child to agree to be raped time after time, night after night, hour after hour? Just shoot her up with heroin. And, you know, my mother made the point during one of Carla's appeals. She's like, when was this woman convicted to death? I maintain it was the first time her mom shot her arm with heroin when she was 12, or maybe it was the time when she was 13 and a man left her bedroom and her mom goes, oh, that was your real dad. And so I don't excuse anything Carla did. It was a horrific double murder that was unplanned, totally unplanned. But she lived in a world of drugs, of massive drugs. I don't think Carla had been sober from the time she was 12 years old. And when I was in college, I'd always been against the death penalty, but when I was in college, my uncle actually made the point to me that it didn't really matter what I thought or what I felt about an issue. What mattered was what I was doing about it. And I hadn't really done much at 20 years of age about anything that I believed in. I just believed in it and I'd argue about it. So there was a story about Carla, a front page story in the Houston Chronicle, about this very unusual case where members of the victims' families, there were two victims. Again, it was unplanned, but she came across a man who his car was not in his driveway, and she and her boyfriend had broken into the apartment to steal his motorcycle that he kept in the living room because he had beaten up Carla's friend, who was his wife, and the wife had given him the apartment. So they drove by. They saw the guy's truck wasn't there, so they thought it was safe to go in and steal the motorcycle, and it was just kind of a – they weren't even going to do anything. They were just going to hide it from him. So her boyfriend went in, and he didn't come out. And Carla went in after a while to see what was going on, and she saw the man on the floor bleeding. And the reason that there was no truck in the driveway was the man had met a woman at a bar that night, and they had come back to his home in her car. So that is an important fact. The crime wasn't planned, but once Carla was in there, the guy named Danny Garrett, who died in prison, gave Carla a pickaxe and wanted her to participate in the crime, and she did, and they found the woman in the bedroom, and it was absolutely horrific. But what's interesting is the state's attorney, a former state's attorney who was assigned to Carla's case, wasn't sure he wanted to take it because he said, this was the most evil person I had ever met. He said, you know, looking in her eyes was the same as looking in Satan's eyes. And years later, he led the charge to try and get her sentence commuted to life in prison because he said, this is a different person than the one that committed this crime. And I didn't know if I bought it when I read the article. So I wrote her a letter. Lots of people wrote letters. For some reason, she wrote me back. And I would say it took me a couple of years to really get to know her and so say, no, this is truly a changed person. And I was very active in her appeals. I was very active, just as a student, you know, active in organizing protest. I stalked Governor Richards endlessly. And I was active in the Democratic Party at the time. So one time I had volunteered for a trip of President Clinton's. And he was always nice about letting us be on the tarmac by Air Force One. And so President Clinton gets out of the car. Governor Richards gets out of the car, and I'm standing right there. I said, Governor Richards, my name is Greg Audell. She goes, Greg, I know who you are. I know what you want me to do. I just don't know how you keep showing up everywhere where I am. But, you know, I felt like she had a part in killing my friend. And people say, well, do you think she should have gotten away with it? No. But what I say is redemption is possible. And I don't believe, for those of us who are listening who call themselves Christians, I'm not saying you have to believe that Carla did change, but what I say is you have to believe that redemption is possible. And I don't believe the state of Texas, the citizens of Texas, the victims, I don't think anyone benefited from having Carla executed, but many people benefited from her being alive and encouraging women in prison. And from in those days, the videos she did to school groups talking about what drugs will do to your life. And I maintain that Carla served a purpose while she was here, and there is no excuse for the crime she committed. But had she lived out her natural life in prison, I think many people's lives would have improved, and no one's ever been able to tell me anything that's been gained by Carla being executed.
You know, Greg, that's a great point you make, and I'm going to bring that up again at the end of the show, because that is a very important point, is what is prison for, reform or punishment? But another thing that we've learned from both of these stories is that when you're on death row, you're there for a long time. And you mentioned that the appeal process takes a very long time. So here we have someone who was exonerated after 15 years.
And thank God it does take a long time.
Yes, yes, thank God it does. Although must be painful sitting in prison waiting to see what happens next. It's a special kind of loneliness that few can fathom. And stories take us through windows of the souls of the tellers. And I think letters written by prisoners offer a window into lives spent alone in tiny cells. So, Hank, I think you have some examples of these.
Oh, I do. That's all right. No, I have a couple, Barry. And by the way, you're doing a terrific job. You want to remind everybody where we are?
Hey, yes, yes. We are on planet Earth. Okay.
Just thought I'd throw that in there.
Yeah, we're on planet Earth. But you are listening to So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 FM with my guest, Ann Clayton, and with all the show's co-hosts. Actually, Warren's here, Hank's here, Greg's here, to celebrate our new one-hour spot. I just got caught up in that story.
Oh, that's all right. Thank you, Mary. No, I appreciate it. And one thing that I found in these kind of letters, and this is one of the examples that you asked me to share with you. Is that language may be a bit flawed, but the messages are incredibly poignant, as most prisoners try to reach for and, I think, ultimately unravel their identities. Lutheran pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer spent 2 years in Nazi prisons before being executed at 39, just a month before the German surrender, and for his role in the plot to assassinate Hitler. In Letters and Papers from Prison, published in 1951, Bonhoeffer's collection of letters depicts the kind of meandering turmoil and agonizing introspection so characteristic of prisoners' letters. In one letter, he writes, "When men are confronted by a bewildering variety of alternatives, the path of duty seems to offer a sure way out. They grasp at the imperative as the one uncertainty. The responsibility for the imperative rests upon its author, not upon its executor. But when men are confined to their limits of duty, they never risk a daring deed on their own responsibility, which is the only way to score a bullseye against evil and defeat it. The man of duty will in the end be forced to give the devil his due." But, you know, there's really no need to look at published works to get a sense of a prisoner's mind. KPFT's Bob Gartner, who's been here a long time, a wonderful, wonderful, steadfast volunteer, brought something to my attention a few weeks ago. One of our fans, John Green, an inmate at the facility at Rocheron, wrote a letter to me expressing his appreciation for So What's Your Story, and included a couple of pieces that he composed. Now, John writes, first of all, "Hank, I love your story, Half Hour Thursday," at the time it was a half hour, "because it's the high point in an otherwise dismal week." I mean, talk about a simple, profound statement. That's got to make us all feel good. I have written back to John telling him that I will read his work on air tonight. It was a couple weeks ago when Greg and I were going to do it, but we were preempted, and hopefully John is listening tonight. I wrote to him, and Bob called him, and I think he is. And John, we so much appreciate this. I want to start with your poem entitled Sometimes. John Green. "Sometimes I feel I'm dearly misunderstood. And sometimes late at night, I feel less than I could. A broken heart and a broken spirit are true, separate items. And someday we'll heal. The other is uncertain. Sometimes I feel my second chance won't come. Sometimes when I cry and I feel all alone, a broken promise and a broken future are two separate paths. Someday it will emerge, for better or for worse. Won't someone wake me up? I'm late for a better life. Won't someone realize I have things to fix, things to heal, besides my own life? Sometimes I feel like giving up is the right thing. Sometimes if I close my eyes, I see the sun shining. I wonder what tomorrow brings before the day ends. With disappointment, my constant companion, why should I ever pretend?" What are your impressions?
Wow.
And what did you think?
Yeah, it's very, very telling.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what does it tell you?
It tells you a host of things. I mean, that, you know, the deepness of the feelings, the... you know, the emotions that are conveyed when people feel that way.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
can I say one thing is, you know, I used to work with, quote, the homeless, unquote. And I don't like terms like the homeless, like inmates, because these are people. And I think that's what I get from John's writings. This is, I mean, it's so easy to negate these people as human beings. And it's not justifying anything they've done, but, you know, they're human beings. And I think that's what comes across in this is a real person, a real thoughtful person. And, you know, I don't know what he's done, but a lot of people have done a lot of dumb things at a young age. And they're a very different person. You know, one of my favorite lines in Shawshank Redemption is when Morgan Freeman is talking to the parole board and they ask if he's been reformed. He's like, I don't even know what that is. He goes, I remember a young, dumb kid that did something dumb. Right. And so that's what I get from this.
Yeah. Nicole, you want to chime in? We're going to ask Warren, too. Warren is out there, but I wanted to get your insight first.
Sure. Sure. This is not Nicole. This is Warren.
Wait. I'm sorry. Is this Warren Holloman, the champion of last night's Moth Story Slam in Houston, Texas?
Oh, Warren. Congratulations.
With one of the best stories I've ever seen at the Moth. Is that Warren Holloman?
Yes, I think so. Thank you.
He is so bashful.
We're going to change your name to Hank.
Back to John's poem. The thing that really struck me was that theme in the middle about awakening, and it reminded me, when I was in college, I read a lot of books by Solzhenitsyn, and he spent a lot of time in prison, too. He's one of the deepest thinkers of, I think, the 20th century. He said the thing that happens in prison is you have time with interest. I'll never forget that. To think, to reflect. And so I think when someone is going through that experience, we need to listen to what they have to say, because they probably have spent less time watching dumb TV shows and more time probably thinking deep thoughts.
You know, I had a college classmate who was on death row. Probably a lot of y'all have heard his name before, David Lee Powell. And as I was trying, the internet was new, and I was trying to figure out what happened to him, and I was delving into these sites, and I almost felt as though I was entering a dark room. I was a little worried that some of my fellow workers would come by and see me entranced in this prison site, reading stories, reading appeals from people asking, will you write to me? It was a very strange, I would actually close my door while I would go do this and go try to find where was David now in his list, in his series of appeals and so on. But these stories that would often start with, I don't know how I ended up here, but here I am, and I need a friend.
You know, I just wanted to say, I don't know if you guys are aware, but I have someone very close to me who is incarcerated for at least 60 years. And it's hard, but to be able to appreciate still the things and of life and what I've been told from my loved one is that, you know, by saying what's on his heart and writing down his thoughts, whether it's a story or a poem, then he's able to live. So I commend this gentleman for writing this poem and reaching out to our show. So if you're listening, we're grateful for you. I'm definitely grateful for you.
Well, and they live in a society where everything's gray and they're a number, and every single thing is telling them that they have no value. And it comes to the point that maybe the only value they have, because they're often, you know, most are not lucky enough to have friends or family who stay in touch, the value they have are the thoughts and what they've learned from their experiences.
You know, the other thing that I've read about is when people are released, so this is a little different from the two stories that we've talked about, but when people are released, society has changed so much. You're released after 10 or 12 years, and now there's iPods, or not even iPods, now there's smartphones, and they're overwhelmed by this technology. It's almost a fear of how to cope with it. And there's actually people who help to take this on. But Hank, I do believe you have another story to read us.
I do. This one a lot of us will like, if you like dogs, and we do. Right, Floyd? Okay, this is entitled Frosty by John. As a small child, I grew up surrounded by a family that not only loved me, but insisted in my continued survival and success. My dad's sister, my Aunt Noreen, was such an advocate. My Aunt Sis, he called her, had no children of her own, so I spent 2 weeks out of the summer of vacation at her house. Sis owned a dog. His name was Frosty. Now, since Sis more or less adopted me as her surrogate child, I suppose that made Frosty and I brothers of sorts. Frosty was the standard poodle. If there is a more obnoxious dog out there, I've yet to come across him. See, one summer, my aunt decided that she was going to Greece on vacation. She asked me if I would house-sit for a month and take care of Frosty. Well, I was 16 years old. We all know what the answer to that is. Hell yes. So she gave me money for good, for food and for emergencies, and bid Frosty and I a fond farewell. Now, since I was going to be there a month, I had decided that I would clean the house from top to bottom. So I rented a steam cleaner and bought enough cleaning supplies to clean an army base. But first, I built Frosty his very own spacious confines in the backyard. And out Frosty went. As I cleaned the house, I found, well, let's just say statuettes of all sorts of little things that Frosty left all over the place. Yes, that's right, doggy do. Carefully hidden in places that no one could possibly find. I swear he did it on purpose. And yet, it seemed impossible for me to get mad at Frosty. In 1978, Frosty, at the ripe old age of 16, passed away in his sleep. My aunt asked my dad, my Uncle David, and Mike, and I to be the pallbearers at his funeral. She bought a small casket and a plot at the local pet cemetery, complete with coffin and clergy to send Frosty on his way to doggy heaven. How could we say no? $2,500 later, Frosty found his peace. It is true that all dogs go to heaven, even Frosty. Amen. Now, we don't have a lot of time to talk
Amen.
About this, but I got to get Greg to talk about this for 30 seconds. Then I get 15, and we're done. Go. Because I know
oh,
you got,
wow.
You
well,
know,
well, you know, those know longtime listeners of our program yeah. know that in May of this year, I lost my 17-year-old soulmate, Kirby. And I was fairly certain I would never have a dog again. And over Christmas, a good friend, Michael Tapley, asked me to watch a rescue dog that he had rescued. And I had no interest. I was not going to have a dog. I didn't want to see a dog. I looked at this dog and I heard Kirby whisper in my ear, "That's our boy." And within 1 minute, I thought, "That's my dog." And I've learned that the heart never gets over a crushing death of a loved one, but it does expand to allow you to love again.
Yeah, and listeners will know, and you know, Greg, that was such a beautiful story about Kirby. And 2 years ago, well, three, no, sorry, 3 years ago, I told a story about Sadie and Hannah, the two dogs that I had. And I swear to God, I had to stop in the middle of one of the shows at the time because I needed Kleenex. I couldn't move on. I couldn't go on. And I was poised and I was ready to go. But I couldn't do it because these were two dogs that were with me throughout literally the most difficult times of my life. You know, Sadie was there to help me pick out outfits when I was on dates. You know, she would say, yeah. "No, don't put that away." Yeah. I mean, the
they
kinds
know.
Of, yeah, the kinds of things that just were remarkable. So I hear you. And, you know, there's something about our furry friends that touch people. And John obviously was touched by the kinds of things that, frankly, and I know that you're reading my mind, that good people are touched by. And like you, I don't know what John did, and we're not here to judge. We're not here to make any kind of evaluation. But one thing for sure, you can't possibly talk about Frosty this way and be a bad person. You can't. And I think that's fair, right? I think that's a fair
Absolutely.
Estimate.
Hank, right? that was beautifully put.
It was beautiful.
Yes. I happen to have a house with two dogs, three cats, and a 75-gallon saltwater fish tank that has fish with personality.
You have
Sounds
cats,
like a happy
but
home.
You know what? The only reason people can walk into your house is you have a humidifier.
Yes,
because it's
true.
Allergy city. You cannot walk near Mary's house without Primatine Mist up your sleeve.
I but live
no,
on Vicks Vapor Rub.
That's okay.
I definitely do. So, yes, yeah, so we're gonna have to have a pet exchange story night one night. But now, for all you techies who tuned in and who used to be able to call in and ask for tech advice on Tech Bites, well, we have a new one here for you. We have a little thing that we call Tips for the Teller, and it's time for your tip tonight. So, let's start with, it's a tip, but you know. No, guys, that doesn't work. So first off, you need to realize that when you're standing there and you just finished a sentence and you go,
Do it now at home. You know what you're doing? You're closing your mouth. And if you just close your mouth at the end of the last word, you don't have to say and you leave a beautiful moment of silence in which everybody is absorbing that sentence uninterrupted by At the opposite end of the spectrum is that's starting a sentence, opening your mouth. And it looks kind of weird with just that mouth hanging open. Don't open your mouth until you are ready to say the first word again. A little time in between doesn't hurt. And the like you know part. Well, you know, like you know, like you know. I don't know. It's like you know. It's huge. Okay? You get where I'm putting that kind of language.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds like my students. I don't really know why you're, I mean, right? Isn't that right, Lisa, Nicole? Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know? Totally. I like it when they tell the story.
That
and they
is,
go. I like it when they tell
so
the story,
right.
And I know when they. I love it when they tell the story. And they go, and my grandmother said, like you know, and I said, no, your grandmother didn't say that. Your grandmother did not say that.
Well, I will have to tell you my like you know story. I went to graduate school in England. I arrived when I was 20 years old in the 70s, and everybody in England speaks in perfect sentences. It's amazing. And that's why you just sit and listen to them. It's not just their accent. It's the fact that they actually speak in perfect sentences. And I had one of these emotional breakup things going on with a boy. And I sat down with my very good English friend. And I was just like, you know, well, like he said this to me. And like, you know, this is how I felt. And like, you know, and she just stopped dead in her tracks. And she said, what's happening to you? So, all right. Greg, who's on tap for next week?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll tell you about that in a second, but I got to chime in real quick with my own like you know story.
Ooh.
Is I was working for a family law attorney, Ellen Grimes, years ago in a custody trial. And because the opposing psychologist couldn't make it, I was allowed to get on the stand and read her deposition. And it wasn't until I was on the stand that I realized this California psychologist, every other line was, well, like, you know. And so in my reading of the report we didn't like, she became like, you know, and we just kept looking at the judge waiting for him to stop me and the other side to object. But they just let me keep going. So I did. Anyway, and we won the case, by the way. My guest next week is one of my favorite kind of guests. He's one of those people who steps on the stage like all of us have done at the Moth Story Hour for the first time, not knowing if he could tell a story, and he knocked it out of the park. His name is Eric Heen. He is a teller that Hank and I met. We looked at each other. We're like, he has to be on the show. He is nothing short of hilarious and yet insightful. And I am really looking forward. He is not to be missed, and I hope you are here with us next Wednesday at 8 o'clock.
Next Wednesday, 8 o'clock. Perfect, perfect. And I just want to take your take on like you know. Ever like you know use like you know in court?
You know, I have not.
Well, you just said it, Ann. You just said it. And I, you know, I'm disgusted by that.
I know. There was sarcasm there.
I know. Really? Really?
Just a tiny bit. Can you imagine a lawyer being sarcastic?
No.
On the radio? Yeah.
The other day, somebody asked me if you're being sarcastic, and I said, no.
Okay. Hank, did you want to tell us something else?
Yes. You know, actually, on Saturday, April 9th, this is a big deal, the Houston Storytellers Guild will hold its annual Liars Contest at Houston Baptist University. This is one fun event, no kidding. And yours truly will be one of the liars, and it's going to be hard for me because I've never told a lie in my life. And so this is going to be a very challenging event.
I'm sorry, I had something
me.
Hard to swallow.
In any event, think about it. It's Saturday, April 9th, and it's on our website. It'll be on the Houston Storytellers website. Nicole gave you that site, www.houstonstorytellers.org, for all the fun facts. And we'll talk about it again in the next couple of weeks.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Warren, you want to chime in?
What do you want me to say?
Oh. And Warren never lies. I can tell you that. Okay, everybody. So, don't know if you caught that, but you're going to hear not only one, maybe two of us from here on out. We're so excited with our one-hour venue. I said, don't know if you caught that, the fact that all four of us are here. And
I love our group shows. We do them rarely, but it's always fun to be with y'all.
It is a lot of fun.
What people don't know is we are actually legitimately friends, and we legitimately enjoy each other. And so it's just so fun when we're able to do this.
We're friends, and we met through storytelling.
We have
these stories just bubbling up that we want to tell. So ever so often, we do double up, and it really is a lot of fun.
We like each other.
It's amazing. Like, it's true.
Like... Yeah.
Like, totally.
Yeah.
To the max.
Lisa and I are feeling excluded. I just wanted to throw that out there.
And we like you. We like you, too.
So, and speaking of storytelling, who was the storytelling in your home growing up?
So, my grandfather was quite the storyteller and practical joker. So, he had some great, great stories. And my father has actually continued in the tradition.
And now...
Oh, yeah, perhaps I do as well.
I think so. I've heard several of your stories, and that's how I knew.
I hear a storyteller in her.
I do. I know. I heard her one night, and I said, I have got to have her tell that story of Ricardo Guerra. So before we leave, I just want to take a couple of minutes. We heard some wonderful stories, but we were talking about a very serious subject, which really is, it's a topic that I think we all need to think about. What is the role of prison in our society? Is it for punishment? We hear about these heinous crimes. I think we heard about one tonight. And, one that everybody talks about all the time and which bubbles to the surface from time to time is the Charles Manson murders. Is it for reform or is it for punishment? And what do you do when the crime is that heinous? Do you lean to punishment? And what about capital punishment? Does it belong in our society? We've just heard a story of someone who was wrongly convicted, who could, I think he had a stay of execution how many times?
Oh, multiple times, I know. At least four or five.
Right, so he could have been...
He was hours away on a number of occasions.
As was Clarence Brandley.
And then Carla Faye, who had reformed.
Right.
And was that really the right thing to do at that point? So I really would like everybody to take these stories away and give this some thought. I think, Greg, you wanted to say something a little more about that.
Well, one thing I want to say is I think we've been doing prison essentially the same way for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I think we have ample evidence that it's not working. If you mistreated an animal for years, would you want to let that animal loose and lock it in a room with your child? I would say no. And essentially what we do is we have no reform in our system. So we treat these people like animals, and then we're like, all right, you're free to go. Go live among us. I'm very proud to be a volunteer with New Beginnings, which is run by a former KPFT engineer, Joe Donaldson, one of my favorite people in the world, who creates a home for inmates and also homeless people to become part of a community and say, look, we're going to work together to build a home. You know, we're going to talk to each other about what's going on. We're going to help each other find work. You're going to build that wall. You're going to, you know, you're going to build a home for the next guy coming out. And we don't, you know, there are not enough Joe Donaldsons or enough New Beginnings in our society, but I think that's what it's going to take. We got to provide some services when people get out, not just throw them on the street and say, hey, good luck to you. You have no skills. You have no resume. You know, we need to figure out what are we going to do with these people when they get out. And I don't think Texas has put an iota's worth of thought into it. And it's scary because they will be living next to your child.
This is so true. And I mentioned earlier how many people who have been incarcerated for many years are not familiar with the technology that abounds now. They don't know how to use it. They're afraid of it. And California has a program in which former prisoners who have found their way back into society help newly released prisoners find a way to deal with this. And they understand what it was like to be in prison, that loneliness that we spoke about before, and then that helps them to move that along, I mean, to help facilitate the moving out. So, Hank, you want to say something?
This is Warren. Can I chime in here?
Absolutely.
Yes.
There was one other continuing theme of Anne's story I wanted to ask her about that just jumped out at me. I had expected there to be one mistake, maybe some DNA sample that was accidentally switched, but instead there were 10 or 12 or 15.
Oh, and I didn't tell you all the stuff. I had more to say.
Yeah, it seemed, it was very, I lost my faith in the legal system there. Is that typical? Has that changed? Is there any recourse to punish those who corrupted the system?
You know, I mean, it's hard. I think one of the hardest things is when you have a group of people who are loyal to each other, like uh-huh. the police force, uh-huh. and one of them is killed. And in that moment, emotions run high. And the moment your emotions run high, you start to rely on gut feelings. And for me, that's discrimination, right? Mm-hmm. You have this tendency to discriminate and go back to your old stereotypes, whereas when you're clear and rational and you can, you know, in the light of day, look at something, you know that's not true. Plus, you know, there's this felony murder theory that anybody involved in the crime should be guilty. Well, what happens if there's no crime being committed?
Yeah.
You're just riding to the store with this guy who you met 2 weeks ago to buy a soda, and he loses it and shoots somebody, a police officer and a bystander. You're not guilty.
Wow.
Good.
Yeah. And I still go back to 15 years because I know I'm a little claustrophobic, and when I think of being in this little room, not to mention that death row is not air conditioned in Huntsville. I don't think people realize. I know that's not the worst thing, but it's pretty harsh. It's pretty harsh in the summertime. Hey, Ann. Want to shout out anything to Radioland out there? Say hello to somebody or good night?
I'd love to say good night to my daughter, who is currently on spring break, and my husband, who's freezing to death in Pittsburgh at the moment.
Oh, in the ice and snow.
That's right. Good night to both of them.
Oh, that's great. And what do you think of the show and the team?
Oh,
you've got us all.
I love the storytelling. I actually went on the website and listened to a bunch of stories, previous stories that were being told, and found myself staying up till the wee hours as I listened to story after story.
People usually feel that way. They do. They usually feel that way when they, you know, hear our voices. It's something they can't do without.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I still want everybody to remember, I've always got on lipstick.
You do. And that makes our hearts melt, Ann. Thank you. I mean, because we do put a lot of work into this show, and we're pretty selective about who we have on the show. And, you know, we want to provide the best and most interesting and entertaining stories to our listeners each and every week on So What's Your Story?
So thanks so much, Ann. Thanks for conveying to us your profound sense of fairness, your connection with the human spirit. You're that type of superlative individual we rely on to keep this crazy world as honest as possible. And thank you, Greg and Hank and Warren and Nicole and Lisa, all for being a part of tonight. So Brian and Jason are next with To Tell the World, another class act on KPFT. So just make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving a great story, and we'll keep bringing stories live to you. Be good to each other. Greg, Warren, Hank, Nicole, Lisa, and I will be forever reminding you that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Got science? The Woodlands Children's Museum is calling all young Einsteins to join in on the learning fun at Science Palooza. The museum will host a different interactive science experiment every day of the week. Enjoy some slime time, make magic magnets, learn about everything from ice orb erosion to rainbow volcanoes. The exploration will happen at the museum located at 4775 West Panther Creek Drive, Suite 280, every day from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday, March 11th to Saturday, March 18th. The activities are included with museum admission. For a full list of scheduled experiments, visit woodlandschildrensmuseum.org or call 281-465-0955. KPFT Houston.
As a KPFT listener, you have a special opportunity to shorten on-air fundraising by pre-pledging securely online at kpft.org before the on-air portion of the drive begins. We count on listeners like you to contribute to the success of each fund drive, and we thank you for your generous and continued support of KPFT. Since listeners' support is what sustains the station, on-air pledge drives are necessary to inspire other KPFT listeners to become listener supporters. But wouldn't it be nice if the on-air portion of the pledge drive were a bit shorter? With your online gift, you can help shorten the on-air drive so we can get you back to the KPFT programming you enjoy. Pre-pledge securely online at kpft.org so that we have it in hand in time to create the final on-air schedule. And thank you again for your continued support of 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
Hello and welcome to Tell the World on 90.1 KPFT. My name is Brian.
My name is Jason.
And thank you for joining us for the next hour. We are very honored and privileged to be in the spot that Technology Bites has occupied for the last 20 plus years. For those who don't know, we were at the 10 p.m. slot for the last few years. And after Technology Bites left, we were one of the people chosen to move up by an hour. So we are, you know, saddened by them leaving, but happy to be a little hour earlier.
Mm.
I will say, programming note, we will have... oh, that was fun.
There's a thing playing.
We will have Lee Hutchinson from Technology Bites on in the next week or so, and we'll be talking about certain technological issues that are really fascinating and important politically.
Ooh, I don't know if we can say from Technology Bites anymore. We might have to name drop his real job. I'm sure he has one.
Yeah, he's the editor of a website, and that's...
I had no idea. I really didn't. Yeah. I was like, yeah, he's the Tech Bites guy.
Technology. But we're going to begin tonight in July of 2001. Now, the number one song in the country was Lady Marmalade from that Moulin Rouge movie. You know, the Voulou Voucouche, whatever. The number one movie at the time was Legally Blonde, which then lost out to Jurassic Park 3, which apparently was a thing. There's a talking velociraptor. But the number one political issue in July of 2001 was healthcare. The Congressional Budget Office put out this really damning and scary projection for healthcare, which essentially predicted a full collapse of Medicare, Medicaid, and veterans healthcare. So in July 2001, the Bush administration decided that they wanted to tackle this issue, mostly because of this enormous public pressure as a result of the CBO's predictions. And so part of what they were trying to do was find a new way to reduce the cost of healthcare. And in other ways, they wanted to begin to privatize much of the government-funded apparatuses of healthcare. This was not a very, you know, popular idea. There had been decades of Republicans looking into the privatization of things like Medicare and Medicaid and the VA. But largely, Republicans who had that idea never really got it past, you know, committee, you know, off the wall. Right. But in 2001, the Bush administration looked into how they could privatize parts of the government funded health care. And out of that, the Bush administration created a subset of Medicare plans that people could enroll into, but would be entirely handled by private insurance companies. Now, here's George W. Bush talking about it.
Second, all seniors today and tomorrow will be offered a range of new Medicare plans, including an improved and updated government plan, as well as others offered by non-government insurance plans. All the Medicare plans must offer benefits at least as comprehensive as the government plan. All will be regulated by the federal government, and all of them must offer prescription drug coverage. Third, everyone enrolled in Medicare will have the power to choose, which plan works best for him or her. The plans will compete with each other, forcing to offer better service, extra benefits, and lower premiums. All seniors in America should enjoy the same freedoms that federal employees have today when it comes to choosing their health care plans.
So the idea was really simple. If you qualify for Medicare, instead of using Medicare, you could enroll with a private insurance company, and then the government would just cover the cost of your health insurance plan and take that money from Medicare to do it. The idea was, you know, basically, if you can have more competition in the market, right? If you can have something that competes with Medicare, then maybe it will drive the cost down of healthcare overall. And maybe, you know, set it on the back burner, you could potentially privatize Medicare. Well, that plan by the Bush White House failed miserably. The private insurance Medicare plans that they tried to create with this sort of weird privatization thing, which took money from Medicare, proved to be far too expensive. It did not create competition between Medicare and private insurance companies. It did not lower the cost of insurance. It actually increased the cost of healthcare. Premiums for people who joined these private insurance companies skyrocketed, and in the end, Medicare lost billions of dollars in this very poorly planned effort by the Bush White House to privatize Medicare. And when all this was going down, as this plan by the Bush White House was just proving to be an utter failure, Republicans ran away from George Bush. Almost every Republican back in 2006 and 2007, they ran away from the Bush administration and what they had just done, and they all said that they were against this policy now, despite all these Republicans actually voting to pass this whole siphoning money out of Medicare plan. And it really became this talking point that you shouldn't take money away from Medicare. That is a bad idea. Republicans paid a major political price because of this failed experiment to take billions of dollars out of Medicare, especially when they lost Congress in 2006. So fast forward a little bit to 2010, when the Affordable Care Act was fully implemented, or not fully implemented, passed and implemented. One of the biggest lies that Republicans told about the Affordable Care Act was that it somehow took $700 billion away from Medicare. The Republican Party learned that when you take money away from Medicare, you face a very real political consequence. And so what Republicans tried to do in 2010 and 2012 was propagate this really false narrative that the Affordable Care Act took $700 billion away from Medicare. They tried to make it sound like it was, you know, astronomically more than what Bush had just done. And remember, Bush paid the price, and so should Obama. What the Affordable Care Act actually did was put restrictions on what hospitals and doctors could charge a patient who has a Medicare plan. But somehow that simple policy transformed into this blatant lie from the Republican Party. So Republicans took this price-reducing measure and used it as in this weird lie about Medicare losing $700 billion. It was just weird. It didn't make a whole lot of sense. It even became a talking point of the 2012 election. Here is Paul Ryan continuing to tell this very fake and easily verifiable lie about the Affordable Care Act during the Republican convention.
And the biggest, coldest power play of all in Obamacare came at the expense of the elderly. You see, even with all the hidden taxes to pay for the healthcare takeover, even with the new law and new taxes on nearly a million small businesses, the planners in Washington still didn't have enough money. They needed more. They needed hundreds of billions more. So they just took it all away from Medicare. $716 billion funneled out of Medicare by President Obama. An obligation we have to our parents and grandparents is being sacrificed, all to pay for a new entitlement we didn't even ask for. The greatest threat to Medicare is Obamacare, and we're going to stop it.
Woo! Yeah, so that was a lie. A lie that Paul Ryan told in front of tens of millions of Americans. The ACA does not take $700 billion away from Medicare. It never did. The way that Paul Ryan came to that conclusion, again, is because Medicare, under the Affordable Care Act, puts price caps on what a patient can be charged. It's that simple.
So we've had this talking point about the Affordable Care Act for the last 8 years now, that essentially the idea of putting price caps on what patients can be charged somehow means Medicare is losing $700 billion. It's a weird logical fallacy, but it has been a Republican talking point for 8 years now. So if it's so bad, you would think this would be one of the top things to eliminate in the repeal effort by Republicans, right? They've got all the power now. I mean, they suffered for actually funneling billions of dollars out of Medicare under Bush. And if price capping patients' costs, you know, somehow means that $700 billion is taken out of Medicare, then you would think that the Republican Party's plan to replace the Affordable Care Act would not have this as part of their plan.
You would think.
But you know what? Hypocrisy be damned. The new Republican plan to repeal the Affordable Care Act has this exact same measure almost word for word. In fact, the only positive thing to come from the release of the Republican plan to replace the ACA is that it will reduce the deficit. But according to the Congressional Budget Office's report, the deficit is only cut because it's keeping those Medicare policies in place, that there should be a price cap on what you can charge Medicare patients. So they're okay now with this thing, I guess, that they have proclaimed to hate for the last 8 years that got Paul Ryan a standing ovation, and he didn't even have to use a PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Many people are saying, it sounds like a dollar, many people are saying that the Republican plan to replace the Affordable Care Act is dead on arrival. And that's true. You've been hearing that a lot. Well, that's not true. Despite what you may be hearing, and no doubt some of it is politically interesting, there's a very good chance that this thing will be passed. Part of why it's important to talk about this bill is because of how the bill is written. Technically speaking, this is not a policy bill. Rather, it's a budget reconciliation bill. And that means they don't need a clear majority to pass it in Congress. They don't need 60 votes in the Senate. They only need 51. That means it cannot be blocked by Democrats by voting. It can't be blocked by filibuster. And Republicans are just fast-tracking it. It's been passed through two committees without any debate. No analysis, no expert consulting, nothing. And we're expecting an actual vote sometime either this week or next week. Now, part of what Republicans are doing is not scheduling the voting date, because honestly, they're hoping to surprise Congress with it. They don't want Democrats to know when it will hit the floor, so, you know, they can't rally or postpone anything. They can't even miss a day of work. They could pass it tonight, and Democrats would be powerless to stop it. Part of what we're going to talk about this hour is what's in this new bill and what it all means.
It's important to, I think, go talk about what's in this bill, largely because it really can be passed. I mean, even on Fox News, I've heard the, oh, it's dead on arrival. I don't think Republicans are going to be able to get it.
No.
And then Sean Hannity gets a little flustered in the face and he's like, oh, well, you know, you Republicans can fall in line.
His hair gets a little uncoiffed.
Yeah. But no, I mean, they have the power to do it. There's actually sort of a rumor mill thing happening in Washington tonight that the congressional or the budget committee is planning on having a vote on it tomorrow. Mm. But that hasn't been, you know, confirmed or anything.
Right.
So right off the bat, as we said, the plan keeps the Medicare price limits intact. But it reduces the overall Medicare trust fund by reducing payroll taxes. Repealing the taxes in the ACA will basically hasten the day when the trust fund is drained by 4 years, which will necessitate earlier cuts to the program or tax increases. So the reason why I think this is important is because if they want to use this, you know, down the road as justification for cutting or privatizing Medicare, you know, that this would be it. They would say, well, there's no more money in Medicare. We have to privatize it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, 2003 and 2006 and 2012, they never really had a justification to eliminate Medicare. This plan actually gives them the justification to do it down the line. And so I think that's kind of why you're hearing, oh, this is, you know, Paul Ryan's baby.
Yes.
This is what he really wants. It's because the math of it works out to where Medicare eventually stops being a thing.
Hmm. Well, the Republican plan allows insurance companies to charge older people a lot more. Under the Affordable Care Act, insurers can only charge older people three times as much as they charge younger people. Under this plan, older people can be charged five times as much.
Yeah, it's very interesting, that kind of price jump. And we'll get to the analytics of that, because that kind of really specifically becomes really interesting of who this ends up affecting the most. But just moving on, because I really want to get through what this plan actually has. The Republican plan undoes Medicaid expansion. So 14 million Americans are insured under the Medicaid expansion. Now, the Republican bill maintains that expansion only until 2020, at which point it revokes it, likely kicking off those 14 million people.
Now, one of the biggest aspects is that the plan eliminates insurance subsidies with a tax credit. Now, basically, this boils down to a deduction on your tax returns. So if you make $30,000 or less, this does nothing for you, other than take away any subsidy you may have used to pay for your insurance. People earning $250,000 a year, or couples who earn $500,000 a year, will get the biggest tax deduction for their health care.
Yeah, so this basically means that rich people won't have to pay for their health care anymore, while almost everyone else will. Those making over $1 million a year are in line for a tax cut averaging almost $50,000 a year. And the richer you are, the more benefit you get. Those in the top 0.1% will get an average tax cut of more than $195,000 a year.
Wow.
So no more simple subsidy. Too bad. Rich people get their health care covered. Everyone else doesn't. That's really fascinating. All of the ACA's taxes would be repealed, which would, again, only benefit the rich. Everything from the tax on tanning salons and medical devices to the surcharge on high-income taxpayers will be gone. This amounts to another enormous tax cut for the wealthy, equaling at least $346 billion over a 10-year period, with every cent going to taxpayers earning more than $200,000 a year.
The bill eliminates the individual mandate. The Republican plan says that if you maintain, quote, continuous coverage, then you'll still be insured despite your pre-existing condition. Now, if you go without insurance for 2 months, you'll have to pay a higher rate once you start getting coverage again. But you'll pay it to the insurance company, not to the federal government.
Now, this is something that hasn't really been as widely discussed. A lot of people are talking about the elimination of the, you know, the subsidy and stuff, mm-hmm. and how limiting the individual mandate will lead to more people dropping off the insurance markets and everything, and, you know, death spiral. But what I think is really fascinating is that basically, if what this does is, if you lose your job or you quit, and it takes you more than, you know, 2 months to find another job, then you will now be fined for not getting a job quickly enough. You know, this then makes it much harder for unemployed people to get a new job, because employers are going to, you know, bear the brunt of that cost. So will they want to hire someone who has been out of work for more than 2 months, knowing that the company will now have to pay twice as much on health care for this one person? And so I think that's something that no one's really
really
addressed.
Not heard about that. Yeah.
The bill also defunds Planned Parenthood. Since no federal dollars can be used to fund abortion, this bill extends this idea that if any place performs an abortion, then they will lose federal money. So this measure shuts down funding for the organization just because it uses other funds to cover those procedures.
Yeah.
So that's an elimination of not just Planned Parenthood, but a lot of different clinics. The bill even shuts down insurance plans that cover abortion. So even if you want to have that, you know, market choice. According to a House Ways and Means Committee, the measure forbids spending federal tax subsidies on health plans that include coverage of abortion, even if the customer doesn't get an abortion. So this would obviously dramatically shrink working Americans' access to insurance-covered abortions, or, would lead to insurers dropping abortion coverage from their plans. There's also the ACA essential health benefits rules, which would be replaced. Now, the Affordable Care Act rules that required qualified health plans to provide hospitalization, maternity care, mental health services, even drug rehabilitation, those would all be eliminated. That's likely to make maternity coverage, among all these other services, much more immensely expensive, and whether or not they're available or not.
Yeah.
So those are kind of the key takeaways. I mean, there's a lot of other kind of nonsense in the bill about, you know, lottery winners can't receive a tax credit. They can't make a deduction if you've won the lottery. So
I hadn't even considered that.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's what they considered.
Wow, the president was right. It's really, really complicated. Who knew?
But yeah, so that's something that was eliminated. So those are the facts of what is intended in this law. The post-analysis stuff is a little scarier. The Congressional Budget Office found that 26 million Americans would lose their insurance under the Republican health care plan. Another 14 million would lose coverage under Medicare, because it's likely that, Medicaid will fail under this plan. There's also an additional 14 million Americans who are projected to drop their coverage if the individual mandate is repealed. So the number you keep hearing in the news is this 26 million figure, but the actual projected number is closer to 54 million Americans losing any kind of health coverage. So the conversation has largely been about insurance, but this is actually the broader number of just healthcare access. That's actually 54 million, according to the CBO.
Yeah, and Republicans were really upset at the CBO and called it a partisan hit job, despite the office being nonpartisan. That was until yesterday, when it was leaked that the White House's own projections estimated 26 million Americans would lose their private insurance plans versus the 24 million CBO estimates. The CBO also found that premiums for older and poor people would raise by 750. Is that right? That's not an extra zero. 750%. That's a lot. Meanwhile, the total tax cut that millionaires will receive will be equal to $157 billion. Also important to note that the CBO said that the Affordable Care Act is actually working really well and is more stable than ever before.
Yeah, that was an interesting kind of note where they didn't directly address it, but they said that the current policy, current healthcare plan, works really well right now.
I'm really curious, what's going to happen when, we get a few years into this, because, they're going to vote, they're going to pass in the next couple of weeks here, likely.
It is a large possibility.
Right. So, what's going to happen in the next couple of years here when people's insurance costs keep rising because we never have addressed the issue of medical costs in the first place? I would love to see what Republicans say then.
Well, part of what's really fascinating about this whole debate is that when you look at the Affordable Care Act, Democrats introduced it in February, passed it in the end of July. Hmm. And what you had was this very prolonged period where Democrats held open committee hearings. Mm-hmm. They allowed Republicans to introduce 150 amendments to the Affordable Care Act, which ultimately killed the public option, which was sort of one of, Senator Obama's planks during his campaign.
Yeah.
And so with this is entirely different. This is truly rushing it through as fast as you can.
Yeah.
And Republicans are kind of in this weird place where there are parts of the Republican Party that are saying it's not conservative enough. This is the biggest government payout and handout that we've ever done. And so if Paul Ryan were to make it more conservative, then it kind of alienates the more moderate base of the Republican Party. If he makes it too conservative than it, or more moderate, more to the left, then it alienates the more conservative side.
Right.
So it's a really difficult place to be in terms of how you get this policy passed and the repercussions when it comes to healthcare, especially. We've seen with the 2010 midterms, we saw with the 2006 midterms, how healthcare really affected those elections.
Well, and you in a way, if you look at the history of when we were passing the Affordable Care Act, it took a few months. During those few months, you saw part of, the rise of the Tea Party, people out there with their pictures of the president in some sort of traditional African dress, Photoshop picture, saying we don't need no Obamacare, socialism, communism, yada, yada.
Yeah.
Months of that. So, maybe, with what's been going on at the town halls, maybe Republicans are just terrified of voters.
Well, let's be clear, though. The Republicans introduced this bill a week ago, and they're trying to get it passed maybe this week, maybe next week. With the Affordable Care Act, you had, a 5-month period of people being able to read it, people being able to analyze it, make projections about it. This is entirely different. And part of that, the argument that you kept hearing back in 2009 was that, Democrats are trying to rush this through as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And so if that's rushing it through, what is this, like warp speed? It's very weird.
Yeah.
Also, of the 70 counties, this is interesting, that would suffer the biggest losses under the current plan, 68 supported Trump. In fact, 14 of the 15 states most affected by this bill voted for Trump with states such as North Carolina, Alaska, Oklahoma, and Nebraska bearing the heaviest burden of all the states. Overall, Trump supporters will face the biggest increase to health care costs.
Yeah, and that's going to play into, you know, I mean, insurance costs are not going to go down. I'm sorry, they're not, because we're never going to address the issue of medical costs in the first place. So you're going to have that piled on top of everybody who voted for Trump taking the biggest part of the burden of the lack of tax cuts and subsidies. I mean, what's going to happen to these guys in 2 years? I mean, Trump is, you know, he is the leader of the populist wing of the Republican Party. And as long as things are going great, the Trump train keeps going, the populists are popular, it's fantastic.
But if people start having to pay $14,000 premiums, then they're going to be in this bad place. And so I definitely could see his administration make this pivot and say, well, we tried, but it's really the Democrats' fault.
I'm curious how long the populists are going to last in power before, you know, because they've been treating John McCain. John McCain ran for president a few years back, if you don't remember. they refer to him kind of as crazy Uncle John from Arizona now. Everybody hears John McCain say something. The administration doesn't like him. None of Trump supporters like him.
Yeah.
He's become the crotchety old man of the party that was founded on crotchety old men. So I don't know. It's nebulous. We're going to see. Maybe we'll get reality back in a couple of years here now.
Maybe. By the way, there's something, I think, a component here to keep an eye on. Raising the debt ceiling became an oddly controversial thing under President Obama. Like, yeah, there was that whole Newt Gingrich shut down the government thing back in the 90s. There was that one little flare-up. But there was just something different about Obama that made Republicans really mad about raising the debt ceiling. But keep an eye on this issue. Next month, at the very beginning of next month, we are poised to need to raise the debt ceiling again. No one is really making a lot of noise about it yet, but one thing to think about is that Trump has not sent any legislation to Congress yet, which is very odd. However, the White House wants this health care bill passed, according to apparently his speech tonight. What might happen? There's just something kind of, I know it gets a little conspiratorial, but something that might happen is that Trump could use the debt ceiling fight to get the Republican health care bill plan passed. In other words, it's at least possible that the president, who's constantly criticized, you know, debt ceiling increases in recent history, may tell Congress that he will only sign an extension if his demands are met. So if the White House wants to actually put pressure on Congress to get this health bill passed, this would be how they would do it.
Interesting.
So we do have some news on the Muslim ban, the travel ban, however you want to phrase it, although according to this judge, it is a Muslim ban. So part of what we were waiting to see with the new Muslim ban was whether or not it created a constitutional crisis, which I know is a little histrionic, but there's good reason to look at it this way. Essentially, what the Trump administration was hoping to do was argue something like, well, you said travel ban one was unconstitutional, but travel ban two, although identical, has a different name. So any court rulings don't really apply. That was their basic argument. And so that is kind of a constitutional crisis. They're just defying the court and reauthorizing the same thing, but under a different name. Well, after losing their first court battle earlier this month, the Trump White House went to another court today, and they lost. Federal court judge in Hawaii has put on a national hold on the Muslim ban tonight. The court found that it would cause irreparable harm to states, irreparable harm to immigrants, and that it was discriminatory towards Muslims. Now, part of what the White House has to deal with is that they can't just pass the same thing twice. So there was a constitutional question if this new ban was even allowed. And so right now we have the states of Washington, Hawaii, California, Massachusetts, New York, and Oregon, who are all legally challenging the ban. Now, Trump said tonight that he wants to take the original ban all the way to the Supreme Court.
Well, yes, because he made that tweet after it already failed in court the first time and said, I'll see you in court. Yeah. So he has to take it to another court to make his tweet make sense, which is often how the administration works.
Well, he said in his speech tonight that he actually wants to go with the original ban, that he wants to just abandon this ban that just happened and go with the original one and take that to the Supreme Court.
Well, let's talk about that for 1 second. The only differences between the original travel ban and this new one is that the new one doesn't block legal citizens or you know, commonly known as green card holders from entering the country. And Iraq has been removed from the list of countries from which travelers are banned. and the ban on Syrian refugees had been changed from indefinite to 120 days with the possibility of extension, which to this administration pretty much is going to mean indefinite.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing is, even if this goes to the Supreme Court, the constitutionality of this law and just the fact that it was referred to as a Muslim ban by Donald Trump before he became president throws that, I mean, that is the context of this ban, no matter what you call it, a travel ban, needing to improve vetting, whatever, because of what he said, this is a Muslim ban.
Yeah.
And that is unconstitutional to try to keep a religious group from entering the United States.
And that's how the court found it.
Right. So if the Supreme Court interprets it differently, I guess he could have a chance, but they'd have to kind of pretend that didn't happen.
Well, here's from the court ruling tonight. It says, because a reasonable, objective observer, enlightened by the specific historical context, contemporaneous public statements, which would be what you're talking about, and specific sequence of events leading to its issuance, would conclude that the executive order was issued with a purpose to disfavor a particular religion in spite of its stated religious neutral purpose. The court finds that plaintiffs and Dr. Elshick, in particular, are likely to succeed on the merits of their Establishment Clause claim. Hmm. And the Establishment Clause is separation of church and state. The government does not favor one religion over another.
Right. And this is the ruling from the Hawaiian court
this
tonight.
This is what just happened tonight.
Okay.
So that is interesting that that's where the court decided to rule on was on the basis of religion.
They also, as the kids say nowadays, threw some shade at the administration. And they also said the illogic of the government's contentions is palpable. The notion that one can demonstrate animus towards any group of people only by targeting all of them at once is fundamentally flawed.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny. The Trump administration could appeal this to the Ninth Circuit Court, which is where the first ban died.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, good luck. I mean, we could see this head to the Supreme Court, but I don't know.
This would be an interesting test of Trump's own new Supreme Court justice. Something that is so blatantly unconstitutional and seeing how he rules on it.
I mean, if we do actually get, Senate hearings on Judge Gorsuch, I'm sure this will be a question that's brought up.
That's a good point.
We'll see. I mean, we'll see whether or not the Senate confirmation hearing is going to happen before this reaches the Supreme Court or after.
Now, another executive order that hasn't been as widely discussed but could become potentially very damaging for this administration has to do with an order the president signed at the beginning of the month. Trump's order targets an EPA rule released under the Obama administration, which designates many smaller creeks, streams, and wetlands as protected under the Clean Water Act of 1972. Essentially, what had been happening was that companies would find small streams and dump their waste into it because those streams were not protected by the EPA. This affected as many as 72 million Americans who get their water directly from these small streams. In Texas, for example, there are about 7 million people who get their water from these small water sources. People, if you own some land, you dig your own well. That's what you do.
Well, it's also smaller towns and
sure,
all that.
Yeah. Yeah. Places you drive through on major highways going between cities, as we do in Texas. The state is huge.
Yeah.
So there's a question as to why Trump would do this. There's no justification given out by the White House for this order. It was signed behind closed doors. Oh, but here's maybe why. Golf courses around the country basically hated this order when it happened because of the chemicals that are used on golf course greens to keep them so green and the nearby water areas. This rule by the EPA made it more expensive for golf courses to function because they now couldn't just dump their toxic whatever chemicals into drinking water. Donald Trump just so happens to own 12 golf courses just in the United States, which means he stands to make money from this executive order.
Yeah, so he this would clearly be a conflict of interest.
Clearly.
So, I mean, this whole, I think, argument about divesting himself from his assets, this calls into question. Every time he does something like this, every time he passes any executive order, that comes into question as to does it affect his bottom line.
Well, it's hard to decide, like, if he's trying to just ignore this whole conflict, because it is one, the emoluments clause, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Because all he has to do for, you know, say like this, the Chinese government renting out office space in Trump Tower. All he has to do is go to Congress and say, hey, guys, is this cool? And the Republican Congress just has to say, yes, Mr. President, it's cool. He's not even doing that. Yeah. He's completely unconcerned.
Well, you did have when President Obama won the Nobel
Prize, right.
He went down to Congress and said, oh, well, this comes with money. May I have this money? And they said, sure.
Yeah. So, and they often will. There's been presidents that have been awarded horses from Spain and all sorts of things. So.
But I think there is a difference between getting an award or, you know, something that expresses an appreciation by a different country.
And writing an executive order that puts money in your pocket.
Yeah.
Big difference.
So, I mean, I can't... Trump hasn't really done a whole lot in terms of policy, in terms of legislation. I mean, you can look at George W. Bush, right? I mean, I know we like to look at Obama because he's the more recent one.
Well, but we have to look at the last Republican president as well,
And you do see these really big, you know, Medicare Part D. You see really big expansions in terms of policy, in terms of how our government works. Being taken place in the first few months. And what we're seeing with Trump are these really arbitrary small things that don't really work or do anything, or they get thrown over by a court. So, I mean, for him to prioritize, oh, I need to make sure my 12 golf courses can make more money.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an obvious conflict of interest.
And I mean, I can see how he would think that this one would fly under the radar because he's pretty much, his administration has been going to war with the EPA. Yeah. To begin with.
Well, I mean, it's been going under the radar, I think, largely because this came out around the same time of the wiretapping nonsense. And we're purposefully not covering that because I don't want to constantly follow Trump's words.
Right.
And instead follow the actions. And so this is more important because this is the actions of what he's doing.
There's also a microwave in the other room and we just can't be sure that it's not listening.
Yeah, I mean, so, this is Pacifica, so, you know.
Yeah.
All right. Well, another corruption issue to keep an eye on has to do with Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Now, a real estate company owned by Jared Kushner, who, as you may recall, is not only Trump's son-in-law, but is also a senior advisor to President Trump, and still, you know, he gets to sit in on top secret intelligence briefings. Well, his company is poised to sign a lucrative deal with the Chinese company Anbang. Now, Anbang is a largely opaque organization where it is believed that the company itself is a tool of the Chinese government.
And let's face it. In China, pretty much any giant company with international dealings is a tool of the Chinese government.
Well, and because of this, Anbang has been denied the ability to purchase property in the United States because of national security issues. It has been repeatedly determined by the U.S. government that Anbang is a front for the Chinese government.
A big surprise.
And so now, Anbang is looking to buy a building from Jared Kushner. The Kushner company purchased a building in New York in 2007 for $1.8 billion. Anbang wants to buy that building from them for over $1 billion more than what Jared Kushner's company paid for it. The deal assumes most of the debt that Jared Kushner owes on that building. The deal would also have to be approved by the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. And the members of that committee are just the members of the president's cabinet. So do you think that they're going to deny the president's son-in-law for making hundreds of millions of dollars?
I don't think that's very likely. And, you know, this is the Chinese president is going to be in town soon. He's going to be heading down to Mar-a-Lago to play some golf with Donald Trump.
Oh, that's fun.
Who does actually play quite a bit of golf, as we've seen.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, this is a kind of an interesting story because it's blatant. It's very blatant in terms of, let me give you $1 billion and...
let me go ahead and make a deal that's not necessarily beneficial to me. It's great. It's cool. Oh, by the way, our president will see you next week.
And let's do this deal with a company that is a front for the Chinese government. And, okay. we're also getting more and more information about General Michael Flynn and his involvement with the Russian government. Now, for those who are out of the loop, sort of a quick summary here. Essentially, it was discovered that General Michael Flynn, who worked early on the Trump campaign and became Trump's national security advisor, was discovered to have been in multiple and repeated contact with the Russian government, both during the campaign, during the transition period, and during the presidency. Now, from what we know, General Flynn made promises and deals to basically benefit Russia by having the administration take a softer stance on Russia and lifting sanctions imposed on Russia for their invasion of Crimea. Now, General Flynn was eventually fired slash resigned by the Trump administration. But according to the White House, the reason he was not or he was fired was not because of these repeated contacts and promises to the Russian government, but because General Flynn lied to poor old Mike Pence. That was the weird reasoning that they decided to give.
Poor, you know, pure of heart Mike Pence, who only wants men to love women.
He lied.
That poor guy.
You can't lie in the White House.
So since then, we've learned a lot. We learned that Acting Attorney General Sally Yates knew about these Russian connections and warned the White House. And for three weeks, they did nothing. We learned that General Flynn was also working as an agent for the government of Turkey, being paid to lobby on their behalf during the campaign, during the transition, and during his time working with President Trump. Which means that while General Flynn was sitting in on top secret briefings, he was also a paid agent of Turkey. We also learned that the White House was informed about this on multiple occasions. Congress sent a formal letter to the White House telling them that General Flynn was being paid by Turkey as an agent. It was also publicly available knowledge since news agencies were reporting on the story back in November, including us here on this show, at our previous time.
Yeah.
We also learned that General Flynn's own lawyers informed Mike Pence and the White House that he was working on behalf of the Turkish government. So the question, which is a question we've repeatedly asked on the show, is when is anyone actually going to investigate this stuff? When will there be a hearing or a trial, and do our government institutions still work?
I find this really fascinating because the Trump administration went out of their way and said, well, he's being fired because he lied to Mike Pence. Because Mike Pence, you know, you can't lie to Mike Pence with that face.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it doesn't make sense that Mike Pence didn't know any of these things.
His heart is as pure as his hair is white.
I mean, Mike Pence was in charge of the transition, and so he was repeatedly informed by Congress. He was informed by General Flynn's own lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
He was, I mean, it was publicly available information. I went through our archives, mm-hmm. and I found when we talked about this back in November, mm-hmm. when it had been initially reported. And so it's not as though, like, this was a secret, at least that we're acting as a Turkey, an agent of Turkey. But the Russia stuff, I mean, that kind of goes into a really different, darker area, especially since General Flynn was working so early on in the Trump campaign.
You know who else was working really early on in the Trump campaign was Paul Manafort.
Yeah,
it's disconcerting when you look at all the other people with connections as well.
Yeah. Well, what else do we have? Oh, we have Jeff Sessions.
Oh, goodness.
We have a whole lot of Jeff Sessions. There's been a lot of concern among the many states that have legalized marijuana whether or not this administration would crack down on them. And we are kind of getting a sort of clear answer on that. Attorney General Jeff Sessions said last week that marijuana is causing an outbreak of violence across the U.S. and is causing people who use marijuana to become more violent because he claims THC levels are through the roof. He actually said tonight that heroin is only slightly worse than marijuana.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Bless America.
Well, the White House last week said that they do plan on doing something to stop states that have legalized marijuana. We don't know what that means yet, but here's something to kind of keep an eye on. In the last 2 weeks, the Justice Department, under Jeff Sessions, has been sending out these warning letters to businesses and events that sell or use marijuana in states where it's been legalized. These warning letters are essentially telling them to shut down operations, to close up their businesses, and cancel their events and concerts. These warning letters then go on to say that marijuana is illegal, and that these legal businesses could face consequences, but they don't say what those are. So this is a test as to whether or not this Justice Department will pursue marijuana in a way that the Obama administration never really did.
All right. Let me say first, we know the science is wrong here, but
yeah.
I will give him credit for one thing. THC levels are much higher than they were when Jeff Sessions used to smoke pot. Because really, the weed is much better nowadays.
Oh.
But it still doesn't make you violent. If anything, I would think that would make you less violent.
Yeah, I would think so, too. I can't imagine the science of it saying that marijuana is only slightly better than heroin. I mean,
oh my gosh.
That's the sort of inverse of what he said tonight.
Right.
But the scientific illiteracy of what we're hearing out of this administration is very weird. I mean, we did hear recently from the guy who became the EPA chief say that carbon dioxide really doesn't contribute to climate change.
Despite, scientists from federal government agencies saying the exact opposite thing for how long leading up to this?
When I heard about the EPA thing, by the way, I thought, maybe it's not as bad as I'm thinking. Like, let me get past the headline. And maybe he's talking about methane, because methane, that's where the big conflict is in the scientific community, whether or not methane really contributes more or not. Maybe it's carbon dioxide, but they both do. And I thought, maybe he's going to talk about methane and the issue of like animal farming and transportation boats.
Sure.
Maybe that's it. No, it wasn't methane. It was just climate change isn't real, and I'm heading the EPA. Also, why is the Justice Department using their resources to intimidate legal businesses?
Yeah, now this isn't the first trouble that a lot of these legal businesses have had with the federal government. If you look in terms of banking, because a lot of banks that do business with the federal government won't deal with these marijuana companies because they view it as money laundering for an illegal business a lot of the time.
Well, the really specific legal part of that is that the banks who work across state lines, since money is kind of digitized in a sort of way, what banks are afraid of is if they start giving out loans or even, having a basic banking account,
right,
then, they're kind of having money across state lines when really they're not. But and so that's been the kind of legal curveball.
Right.
And that's entirely on the federal government. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like actually sending out threatening letters.
Oh, sure. As far as legal action. Yeah, this is new territory now, especially since the legalization in these states.
Well, during the campaign, Trump pledged to leave marijuana legalization up to the states. In fact, he argued that it should be a states' rights issue, which was one thing that I think made him really popular among populist conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
The Obama administration decided to leave it to the states, which is, I think, a very Republican stance, right? I mean, that's like Republicanism 101.
Yeah, states. Yeah, they like them.
You enroll and... leave it to the states.
Yep.
Abortion is murder. And that's how you get your Republican degree. Sorry.
Just those two phrases.
That's
just
how you
say
get
them.
$700 billion out of Medicare.
Also important to note, marijuana jobs are outpacing manufacturing jobs because robots don't smoke pot. No, but it's been estimated that over the next 3 years, legalized marijuana will create 300,000 jobs.
That is, I think, an interesting point to make here, is that while this industry is very limited in where it's happening, in terms of job growth of the industry itself, it's outpacing coal mining jobs. It's outpacing, like you just said, manufacturing jobs. And so the possibility for employment and changes in our market, that's very real.
Yeah.
And sort of the automation of a lot of our industries, this is one area where it's just really not happening, because a lot of this does have to be handled by hand.
Yeah.
And, that might change. Industries are always subject to change. But in terms of growth, if they were to really go after marijuana, then you would start seeing the loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you could probably automate some marijuana jobs, but it's not like regular agriculture. Like, regular agriculture would be really expensive to have robots picking everything, because right now we have undocumented workers picking everything, and they're much cheaper than robots.
Yeah.
So I don't know where the marijuana industry is on that. But yeah, 300,000 jobs, that's a big deal. And, especially if this spreads to more states, if more states are able to legalize marijuana, which is the future as long as Trump's administration doesn't step in here, we're talking about a lot more job growth.
Yeah. And so, we are seeing right now that several states will have this on, or will potentially have this on the ballot this year and next year. Mm. And so it's only growing.
Yeah.
And so the only thing really stopping that growth is Jeff Sessions.
Jeff Sessions.
Well, the Monday before last, the Justice Department dropped its objections to Texas's voter ID laws that are heading to the Supreme Court. Now, the Obama administration initially sued Texas to block the voter ID laws here in the state, where a federal court eventually ruled that the voter ID laws were in fact used to target minorities and Democrats. Republican lawmakers even made the mistake of admitting to all of that they really did intend to block racial minorities and Democrats from voting. However, the Justice Department under Jeff Sessions has decided to drop the government's case against Texas. Now, regardless, the Justice Department will not was not the only complainant in this case, so it's still going forward. If the court finds that Texas acted with discriminatory intent, which, again, Texas lawmakers were caught admitting that they were trying to discriminate against people of color and Democrats, then Texas would have this law revoked, and Texas would be subject to federal approval before it makes any future changes to voting laws or procedures. That being said, it is the Justice Department who would be making those decisions on approving changes to Texas's voting system. So this is a really fascinating circle of life issue in terms of voting rights, because you have this really weird thing where there really was blatant racial discrimination happening and really blatant attempts to suppress the vote and suppress voters in general. And, you know, what's happening here is that the Justice Department has decided that, you know what, who cares? So we'll see if that goes to the Supreme Court. But I do want to move on. So Congress hasn't been particularly busy in terms of passing legislation. But one thing that they are very good at is shielding the president. Or at least Republicans have been at work protecting Donald Trump as much as possible. On the Tuesday before last, Republican lawmakers in Congress voted to hide government information about Trump and Russia, as well as any information related to his tax returns. Now, a resolution in the House would have turned over a great deal of information to the House Judiciary Committee. However, Republican lawmakers unanimously voted against that resolution. Specifically, it would have asked the DOJ to turn over within 14 days any information relevant to conflicts of interest stemming from Trump's decision to maintain ownership of his companies, any ethics violations pertaining to Trump or any of his federal employees, payments by foreign governments made to organizations that Trump owns, which is a violation of the Constitution's emoluments clause, which is something we talked about a little bit earlier, and any information the DOJ has about connections between Trump and his staff and Russia. All of this is also happening while Republicans block any kind of independent investigation of the president and his many ties to Russia. Now, meanwhile, the chairman of the committee that will supposedly conduct the investigation, well, he's been calling reporters and telling them that there's nothing to see here about this whole Trump and Russia stuff. So if the chair of the committee is openly going around and saying, you know what, don't pay attention, don't listen, it doesn't matter, do you think he's going to really pursue this in a fair and just manner?
You know, my gut says no. I'm inspired because we played a little George Bush. I feel like I should just go with my gut and not anything that I've read or heard. And I would say no.
Okay.
But you're right about Congress being a shield. And, you know, even if the House does, you know, in some way bring up these issues with the Emoluments Clause, once again, all Congress has to do is go, you know what? It's okay.
Yeah.
It's all good.
I mean, it's a simple way to kind of get around it.
Yeah.
Now, I do want to kind of jump down a bit here because I do want to get to Texas. Here in Texas, we're seeing kind of a slew of anti-gay bills being run through the Texas legislature. Yesterday, the Texas Senate approved a bathroom bill which will require people to go by the sex listed on their birth certificate when using restrooms, locker rooms, and showers. Now, that bill will be sent to the House for another vote. There's also a so-called religious freedom bill, which would allow businesses and government employees to deny services to LGBT individuals on the basis of religion. Now, that bill has moved forward, so we can expect a vote on that sometime soon. Now, the estimated loss of revenue, should these bills become law, is at about $2 billion a year, which is a lot, especially since we're fighting over, you know, school funding and all that.
Right.
And finally, there's another anti-gay bill that would allow government agencies and private institutions that handle adoptions to deny LGBT individuals the ability to adopt or foster a child. Now, the language could also affect foster children of non-Christian faiths, as well as unwed mothers. Now, a similar law was passed in Mississippi, which was deemed unconstitutional by a federal court last year.
Yeah, I think that you and I both know some people, both personally know some people, that were at the Capitol giving testimony for this, or against this, rather, these bills passing.
Well, I mean, this is kind of, I think, what we talked about after the Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage was that the sort of overreaction and the tactics that were going to come down the line as a way to counter the same-sex marriage ruling and counter any kind of equality issuances that came from that ruling. And, I mean, here it is. We're seeing it. We're seeing it manifest in very real ways, in very consequential ways. And they're going to have these really broader effects. I mean, the specific stuff is the bathroom bill nonsense, which is just weird and dumb. And we've talked, I think, endlessly in our 10 p.m. slot about this.
Yeah.
And we could talk endlessly, but we've only got a few more minutes left. But, I mean, seeing the actual work being done, the sort of test driving it in North Carolina, the sort of test driving it in Mississippi, and now with Texas being this really giant, I think, Republican policy state where the constitutionality of states of certain kinds of policies are tested here so that they can be enacted in a more broader way. We're seeing that happen now, and we're seeing it with, you know, this bathroom bill nonsense and this religious freedom bill and this whole weird thing about gay people can't adopt kids anymore.
Right. No, I mean, that is straight from Russia. That is a policy in Russia, by the way.
Yeah, actually, you are correct. I mean,
and has been for a long time.
What I mean, like, that's not a, you know, a metaphor. That is actual policy in Russia.
Yeah.
I think that on a more personal level, I feel like that specific bill is just vicious.
Yeah.
Which I know is like a very emotional way to look at it, but it is a sort of vicious way to say, you want to get married, well, good luck having kids. And that's kind of what this is. And you know, there are so many, you know, we listened to Amy Poehler last week when we were continuing the International Women's Day, because we wanted to extend it by an hour, and we found all these great inspirational speeches. And, you know, she said that in that speech that we aired, that there are millions of children that have nothing, and they, you know, want to be adopted. They want to have parents. They want to be in a loving home. And for some reason, the Texas legislature is now saying, well, because gay people got their right to marriage, this is the retaliation, and those kids are going to suffer because of it.
Yeah.
And so that's the policy position that the Republican Party in Texas is now deciding to take.
Well, we know that this is what Texas lawmakers like to do. Every single time something that they pass fails, they just find another one and get it through there. We've seen this with Planned Parenthood. They will enact a law long enough for it to affect a certain number of people, like the admitting privileges for Planned Parenthood. And then when that fails, they go, okay, we got another one. You have to have Christian burials for your aborted fetuses.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous.
And I mean, it's laws like these where I think that deep down they know that it's going to fail a constitutional test.
But in the meantime,
they can do as much damage as possible.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this right here is very real in terms of the human cost and the human consequences.
I especially when you look at, you know, numbers of, you know, LGBT homeless youth, you know, kids that need homes that aren't straight, that aren't taken in by Christian organizations, that, you know, don't have anywhere to go after they turn 18. They have to leave the homes that they're in. It's tough. It's tough. Yeah. It's you know, they are waging war right now.
I do wonder about after the same-sex marriage ruling, you had all these LGBT organizations that said, you know, doors closed. We finished our mission.
Right.
And I felt like when I saw that happening, I thought that was very short-sighted.
That's frustrating.
Because, you know, we are now seeing these issues perk up, and we're seeing it happening on state by state by state by state. Well, that does it for us, our first 9 p.m. show.
Hey, little programming note. So coming up next, we're going to be playing Flashpoints for the next hour. That is a subject in this Future to Change, but we will be at 9 o'clock every week on Wednesday.
Unless we get canceled.
I guess there's that.
Well, thank you, Malik. Thank you for listening. 90.1 KPFD.
Partners Emergency Centers, located at 6380 North Eldridge Parkway, will host Embrace the Spectrum, its first annual Autism Awareness Festival. This free event takes place on April 2nd from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. to raise awareness for individuals diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders. Partners Emergency Centers, expert speakers, and other organizations in attendance will educate families about all the wonderful resources that are available for those with this disorder. Event highlights also include free CPR classes, free food, and bounce houses. Everyone is encouraged to come and support this wonderful cause. KPFT Houston.
Purple rain, purple rain. Oh, purple rain, purple rain.
Community is all about connection. And KPFT is seeking local organizations, businesses, and individuals to participate in our Community Partner Program. Community partners help KPFT by supporting station initiatives, reducing our pledge drives, and being key contributors to our success. As a community partner, your organization or business becomes invested in a richer way in KPFT and helps to keep local independent media flowing. Interested in being a community partner? Well, contact us by email at brian@kpft.org. Thanks for your interest in our Community Partners program. This is KPFT Houston.
You are listening to 90.1 KPFT Houston.